Welcome to the reading of the New York Times for Thursday, June 8th, 2023. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. The New York Times is donated to Radio Eye by the Lexington Herald Leader. Your reader for today is Scott Johnson. We'll start today's reading with the Merriam-Webster Word of the Day. And today's word is etiquette. Etiquette. Etiquette refers to the rules of proper and polite behavior that are expected in social or official life. As in, her failure to respond to the invitation was a serious breach of etiquette. Today's front page headlines from the national print edition of the New York Times. Documents case targeting Trump, notification says. Charges may be near. Letter to his legal team suggests the inquiry is largely done. Northern fires spread smoke and anxiety. Blazes across Canada, also choking U.S. DeSantis bets provocation is winning strategy. 13 months in, CNN's leader is pushed out. It just keeps coming, ravaged by Ukraine war, then by a flood. And years later, prosecutors revisit police killings. Charges are rare. We'll begin with the story headlined, "Prosecutors tell Trump's legal team he is a target of investigation." It's by Alan Foyer, Maggie Haberman, William K. Rashbaum, and Glenn Thrush. Federal prosecutors have informed the legal team for former President Donald J. Trump that he is a target of their investigation into his handling of classified documents after he left office, according to two people familiar with the matter. The notification to Mr. Trump's team by prosecutors from the Office of the Special Counsel, Jack Smith, was the clearest signal yet that the former president is likely to face charges in the investigation. It remained unclear when Mr. Trump's team was told that he was a target of the special counsel's inquiry, but the notice suggested that prosecutors working for Mr. Smith had largely completed their investigation and were moving toward bringing an indictment. In court papers last year, prosecutors indicated that they were scrutinizing whether Mr. Trump had broken laws governing the handling of national security documents and whether he had obstructed government efforts to retrieve them. Mr. Trump was found to have had more than 300 documents with classified markings at Mar-a-Lago, his private club and residence in Florida, including some found in a search there by FBI agents 2 months after lawyers for the former president said a diligent search had not turned up any more, notifying a potential defendant that he or she is a target is a formal way of indicating that the person is a direct focus of a criminal investigation and often precedes the filing of charges. The notification typically opens the door to defense lawyers requesting a meeting with prosecutors to offer their side of the story. On Monday, three of Mr. Trump's lawyers, James Trusty, John Rowley, and Lindsey Halligan, met for almost 2 hours with Mr. Smith and others at the Justice Department in what people close to Mr. Trump described as a final effort to stave off charges and alert top prosecutors of what they believe to be misconduct in Mr. Smith's investigation. On Wednesday, witnesses continued to appear in front of a federal grand jury in Miami that was hearing evidence in the documents case, among them Taylor Budowich, one of Mr. Trump's former spokesmen. Aides and advisors to Mr. Trump spent the day in a state of high tension. As Mr. Budowich completed his grand jury appearance, John Solomon, a conservative journalist who serves as one of Mr. Trump's representatives to the National Archives, published an article claiming that prosecutors were moving toward indicting Mr. Trump imminently. New York Times contacted Mr. Trump directly to ask if he had in fact been told that he would be indicted, and he has said it was, quote, not true, end quote. But when asked if he had been told he is a target of a federal investigation, Mr. Trump did not respond directly, saying, "You have to understand," that he was not in direct touch with prosecutors. He then repeated that it's not true that he was told he will be indicted. A short time later, Mr. Trump, who was at his club in Bedminster, New Jersey, posted a message denying Mr. Solomon's claim on his social media platform. "No one has told me I'm being indicted," Mr. Trump wrote, quote, "and I shouldn't be because I've done nothing wrong, but I have assumed for years that I am a target of the weaponized DOJ and FBI," end quote. Most of the documents investigation has been conducted by a grand jury sitting in Washington, which has heard from numerous witnesses over the past several months, including some of Mr. Trump's White House advisors, some low-level workers at Mar-a-Lago, and more than 20 members of his Secret Service security detail. Only a handful of witnesses, including some Mar-a-Lago employees, have appeared so far before the grand jury in Miami, which seems to have started hearing evidence last month, according to people familiar with its workings. It remains uncertain how many more witnesses are scheduled to testify before the Miami grand jury. Recently, there have been indications that the grand jury in Washington has either expired or paused hearing testimony, according to several people who are familiar with its workings. Some of those people said the last witnesses to appear for questioning in Washington did so in early or mid-May. Should prosecutors ultimately charge Mr. Trump, an outcome he and some of his advisors are said to believe is likely, it remains an open question whether Mr. Smith's team would file an indictment in Washington, Miami, or both cities. The special counsel's office is also conducting a separate inquiry into Mr. Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. The status of that investigation seems to be lagging somewhat behind the classified documents case. Mr. Trump's former chief strategist, Stephen K. Bannon, was recently subpoenaed for testimony and documents in the January 6th investigation, according to a person familiar with the matter. Mr. Trump is already under indictment in New York by a local prosecutor in a hush money case, and is under scrutiny by a prosecutor in Georgia over his efforts to overturn his election loss in that state in 2020. Federal prosecutors appeared to be still assembling evidence in the documents investigation on Wednesday. Mr. Budowich appeared at the Miami courthouse around 9 a.m. for an hour or two of questions in front of the grand jury. One matter that prosecutors were interested in asking about was a statement that Mr. Trump had his aides draft shortly after news broke that National Archives officials had recovered 15 boxes of material from him in January 2022. Mr. Budowich was Mr. Trump's spokesman at the time. The statement that Mr. Trump initially wanted to send, according to two people briefed on the matter, said that he had returned all the presidential material he had. A draft was written, according to people familiar with the matter. Prosecutors have that draft and have asked witnesses about emails that aides sent about it, according to people briefed on the matter. The contention in the draft statement that Mr. Trump had returned all government records in his possession turned out to be false. After finding that the 15 boxes contained highly sensitive documents, prosecutors issued a subpoena demanding the return of any classified documents still in Mr. Trump's possession. Mr. Trump's lawyers subsequently turned over more, but the later FBI search found more. The statement that Mr. Trump actually sent out after the return of the 15 boxes in early 2022 did not assert that he had returned all the government material in his possession. After his grand jury appearance ended, Mr. Budowich posted a message on Twitter saying he had answered every question honestly. He described the inquiry as a bogus and deeply troubling effort to use the power of government to, in his words, get Trump. His lawyer, Stanley Woodward Jr., declined to comment. While many of the central events in the documents inquiry occurred in Florida, perhaps most notably the search of Mar-a-Lago last summer, the case was opened by national security prosecutors working out of the Justice Department in Washington. Legal experts have debated which location would provide prosecutors with the best venue to sustain criminal charges. Our next story is headlined, "Wildfires Spread Smoke and Anxiety Across Canada to the U.S." It is by Dan Bilewski, Liam Stack, and Fiosa Asai. Canada, on Wednesday, was struggling to fight an extraordinary outbreak of wildfires across the country that sent smoke pouring over the border and forced millions of Canadians and Americans to stay indoors as skies darkened over large portions of both nations. Over 400 fires burned in Canada, and blazes this year have already scorched roughly 9.8 million acres of forest, more than 10 times the acreage that had burned by this time last year, officials say, sending smoke billowing down the east coast of the United States from New York past Washington, D.C., and as far west as Minnesota. In Canada, a country known for its picturesque landscapes and orderliness, the out-of-control wildfires have stoked national anxiety. They've also stretched firefighting resources in a sprawling and decentralized country where firefighting is managed at the provincial level and made coordination more difficult at a time when global warming has intensified the wildfire season. In Ottawa, the capital, a feeling of a country under siege was highlighted on Wednesday by the sight of a thick haze hovering over Parliament Hill and over the soaring Gothic Revival building that is part of Canada's Parliament in Ottawa. The effects from the Canadian wildfires stunned the United States. Smoke obscured the New York City skyline on Wednesday, turning the outlines of its skyscrapers into ghostly silhouettes. Climate research suggests that heat and drought associated with global warming are major reasons for the increase in bigger and stronger fires in Canada. Canada has the world's largest intact forest ecosystem. Drought and high heat, which many parts of the country have experienced recently, can make trees vulnerable to fire and dry out dead grass, pine needles, and any other material on the bottom of the forest floor that act as kindling when a fire sweeps through a forest. Wildfire experts see the signs of climate change in the dryness, intense heat, and longer fire season that have made these fires more extreme. Across a swath of North America, commuters slipped on COVID masks to walk the streets, schools canceled field trips, and some closed. Flights were canceled. Officials urged millions of people to stay indoors, as smoke blotted out the sun. In Canada, the wildfires have exerted a heavy human toll, including displacing tens of thousands of people. The level of unpredictability caused by the blazes is so high that provincial wildlife authorities, or wildfire authorities, in British Columbia have warned local residents to have a go bag at the ready, along with an evacuation plan. Millions of Canadians in Ottawa, Toronto, and Montreal woke up Wednesday to a haze of smoke over large sections of their cities as wildfires expanded to places that had previously felt largely immune to fires blazing in faraway provinces. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada said that hundreds of soldiers had been deployed across the country to help with firefighting efforts. Unfortunately, over the past years, we've seen extreme weather events increase in their intensity and their impact on Canadians, as well as on their cost to families, to provinces, and to the federal budget, Mr. Trudeau said. An apocalyptic haze in shades of beige thickened over northeastern U.S. cities throughout the day on Wednesday, drawing out anxieties about climate change from everyday New Yorkers and health warnings from Governor Kathy Hochul of New York and Mayor Eric Adams of New York City. In the cities most affected, including Buffalo and Binghamton in upstate New York, thick clouds of orange plunged the area into unusually cold temperatures as conditions worsened across the Northeast. Schools in New York City and Washington, D.C. canceled outdoor activities for the day. Zoos in New York closed early out of concern for the animals, and Philadelphia warned residents to stay inside. The smoke and poor air quality also led to the cancellation of various cultural performances and sporting events, including a Yankees game in the Bronx and a Phillies game in Philadelphia. As smoke seeped into theaters in New York City, alarming both ticket holders and performers, the Broadway production of Hamilton and a free Shakespeare in the Park production of Hamlet both canceled performances. "People are scared to come out in the smoke," said Remy Hernandez, 40, a Bronx resident who delivers food orders for Uber Eats and DoorDash. Quote, "To me, it looks like the world is ending," end quote. The hazy conditions in New York are likely to continue on Thursday and Friday and could linger over the weekend, according to Basil Segos, the commissioner of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. On Wednesday, he told reporters that clearing the skies would take an act of God. Quote, "We'll pray for rains up north and for winds to shift," end quote. Much of New York State was under an air quality health advisory alert that was to remain in effect until Wednesday night. By Wednesday afternoon, the air quality index in the broader New York City region surpassed 400, the worst since the Environmental Protection Agency began recording air quality measurements in 1999. Such a reading indicates that the air is unhealthy for all people, not just the vulnerable, and is somewhat typical in smoggy megacities like Jakarta or New Delhi. But it is unusual in New York City, where decades of state and federal laws have helped reduce emissions and clear the air, especially in middle and upper-class neighborhoods. The scope and scale of the wildfires in Canada have underscored the challenges of fighting fires in a vast country. Wildfire emergency response management is handled by each of the 10 provinces and 3 territories in Canada, but hundreds of blazes across the country have stretched local resources thin and renewed calls for a national firefighting service. It is rare to see this much wildfire nationally across Canada all at the same time, said Rob Schweitzer, executive director of BC Wildfire Services in British Columbia. Quote, "In the past, provinces have been able to share resources, but now that is under strain given the amount of fire on the landscape," end quote. Richard Cannings, a member of parliament with the New Democratic Party, said wildfire activity had made it imperative to keep a national stockpile of equipment, such as a squadron of water bombers that could be quickly deployed. Speaking with reporters on Wednesday, Mr. Trudeau did not address the call for a national firefighting service, but said that his government was considering creating a federal disaster response organization. "We need to continue to make sure we are doing everything possible to both keep Canadians safe when these extreme weather events hit, but also make sure we're doing everything we can to predict, protect, and act ahead of more of these events coming." That's a quote. Firefighters from the United States, South Africa, France, Australia, and New Zealand, along with members of the Canadian Armed Forces, were supporting overwhelmed local fire crews. Over the past few weeks, the wildfires in Canada have stretched nearly 2,900 miles from British Columbia on the west coast to Nova Scotia in the east, convulsing the country, causing fears about lost livelihoods, burning down properties, and endangering health. Health authorities have warned that fire smoke could cause symptoms ranging from sore and watery eyes to coughing, dizziness, chest pains, and heart palpitations. Some health officials have advised residents to wear protective masks, conjuring bad memories of pandemic times. Ms. Hochul of New York said the state was releasing 1 million N95 masks from its stockpile to be given out at public places like parks and subway stations. Meteorologists said they expected the plume of smoke buffeting Toronto, the country's largest city and its financial capital, to worsen on Thursday because of winds, and Environment Canada warned residents to brace for worsening air quality. In Ottawa, the Ottawa Red Blacks, the city's Canadian Football League team, switched from outdoor to indoor practice. And in Toronto, the Blue Jays announced that they would close their domed stadiums for a game against the Houston Astros Wednesday night. The wildfires were also hurting businesses, with many mining companies suspending operations in Quebec. The wildfires have rattled British Columbia and Alberta, an oil and gas-producing province, for weeks. Roughly 29,000 people were evacuated from Alberta, a number that had fallen on Wednesday to 3,900. On the east coast of Canada, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, a wildfire late last month forced the evacuation of more than 16,000 people. In Ottawa on Wednesday, Bogdan Wozniak, 72, a distraught hot dog stand vendor, said his business had always been weather dependent, but smoke or fire were other level challenges. "For smoke, you cannot be prepared," he said. "You have the mask," he said. "That's all. I'll be lucky if I break even today," he added. Our next story is headlined, "Chris Licht is out at CNN, leaving network at a crossroads." It's by John Koblin, Benjamin Mullen, Michael M. Grinbaum, and James B. Stewart. At 7 a.m. on Wednesday, as a cloud of smoke enveloped Manhattan, Chris Licht left his apartment building and strolled half a block to Central Park for a meeting with his boss, David Zaslav. The men had taken this park walk before. In early 2022, Mr. Zaslav used the same verdant setting to offer a job that Mr. Licht would later describe as a calling, the chairmanship of CNN, which Mr. Zaslav's corporate empire was about to acquire in a media deal. This time, the walk was briefer and the message tougher. Mr. Licht was fired after just 13 months. His abrupt exit was the latest convulsion for one of the world's preeminent news organizations, whose unyielding string of crises has sapped newsroom morale, eaten into profits, and raised questions about the viability of down-the-middle TV journalism in a polarized age. It was also a hammer blow to Mr. Licht, a successful television producer with little experience managing a large organization, who had pledged to remake CNN as a fair-minded voice for viewers disenchanted with the partisan scrum of cable news. Even as his troubles mounted, plunging ratings, a Don Lemon scandal, and a much-criticized town hall with former President Donald J. Trump, Mr. Licht told associates he was certain that Mr. Zaslav, whom he considered a mentor, would defend him. This week, Mr. Zaslav's support reached its limit. "For a number of reasons, things didn't work out, and that's unfortunate," said Mr. Zaslav, the chief executive of Warner Brothers Discovery, told CNN staff on a call roughly 2 hours after he fired Mr. Licht on Wednesday, according to a recording of his remarks. "This job," he added, "was never going to be easy." In a statement, Mr. Licht said, quote, "This was an exciting but incredibly challenging assignment, and I learned a lot over the past 13 months. I've been lucky enough to have had a successful, fulfilling career, and I look forward to my next chapter," end quote. Although Mr. Licht, 51, had endured criticism for months, his standing deteriorated late last week when The Atlantic published a 15,000-word profile extensively documenting his stormy tenure. Mr. Licht had spent hours with the writer, Tim Alberta, and his unguarded comments that CNN had overhyped its coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and the Trump presidency further rankled the network's anchors and rank and file. Mr. Licht apologized to his staff on a Monday morning call. Quote, "To those whose trust I've lost, I will fight like hell to win it back," he said. But Mr. Zaslav concluded soon afterward that his hand-picked CNN chief had irreparably lost the room, according to two people briefed on the decision. Among the anchors who expressed misgivings about Mr. Licht in recent days were Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper, according to two people. Mr. Zaslav did not consider other candidates before offering Mr. Licht the position last year. "Chris poured his heart and soul into this job," Mr. Zaslav said on the call. "It's really unfortunate that ultimately that's on me. I take full responsibility for that." Three CNN veterans, Amy Antelis, Virginia Moseley, and Eric Sherling, will lead the network until a permanent leader is chosen, a process that Mr. Zaslav said could take several months. The three will work with David Levy, a top Zaslav deputy who was installed late last week as CNN's chief operating officer. Several of Mr. Licht's senior aides were also dismissed on Wednesday, including his global head of communications, Christine Karate Kelly. CNN now faces a crossroads yet again. Whoever replaces Mr. Licht will need to tackle the continuing decline in cable news viewership, puzzle out the network's streaming strategy, and lead coverage of the 2024 presidential campaign. The network has been in a state of tumult since late 2021, when its top-rated anchor Chris Cuomo was fired in an ethics scandal. Weeks later, its longtime leader, Jeff Zucker, was ousted after failing to disclose a workplace romantic relationship. Mr. Zaslav took over in April 2022 and promptly shut down CNN Plus, the three-week-old streaming service that was supposed to secure the network's digital future, resulting in scores of layoffs. Many network stars remained loyal to Mr. Zucker, who led CNN, amid unrelenting attacks from Mr. Trump, and they were suspicious of Mr. Licht's efforts to change the tenor of the network's coverage. Mr. Licht dismissed Brian Stelter, a media correspondent, and Zucker hire, who was often critical of Mr. Trump. and he courted Republican officials and conservatives to appear on the network's programs. He also picked an office on a corporate floor high above the newsroom, an attempt, Mr. Licht said privately, to empower his deputies. It had the reverse effect. Subordinates wondered if their boss cared about what they were doing. From the instant he was named, Mr. Licht confronted a powerful cadre of current and former staff members and their allies loyal to Mr. Zucker and his vision for the network. Mr. Zucker turned into a quasi-grievance switchboard for this group. Mr. Licht, who previously served as executive producer of Morning Joe, CBS This Morning, and Late Show with Stephen Colbert, had never run an organization anywhere near the size or complexity of CNN, a worldwide outlet with thousands of employees and hundreds of millions in annual revenue. A few early errors might have been overlooked if offset by a spate of smart programming moves and ratings wins. But in his 13-month tenure, those were in short supply. His first bet was a new morning show hosted by Mr. Lemon, Poppy Harlow, and Caitlin Collins, with which Mr. Licht said would set the tone for the news organization. But CNN This Morning, which debuted in November, was marred by low ratings and tensions on and off the set. Mr. Lemon clashed with Ms. Collins and then set off a national uproar by asserting on the air that a woman over the age of 50 was not in her prime. 2 months later, Mr. Lemon was fired. Meanwhile, Mr. Licht took his time, in the eyes of Warner Brothers Discovery executives too much time, to fix a primetime lineup that was rapidly losing viewers. In February, he began an experiment at 9 p.m., CNN's highest-rated hour under Mr. Cuomo, with a mix of town halls and single-topic specials. It was a dud, and CNN saw some of its lowest viewership in more than two decades. But no single editorial decision was more contentious than Mr. Licht's decision to broadcast a live forum with Mr. Trump last month. It was the former president's first primetime appearance since 2020 on a major TV news network besides those controlled by Rupert Murdoch. And critics wondered if Mr. Licht was repeating Mr. Zucker's 2016 pattern of providing Mr. Trump with unfiltered airtime. Mr. Zasloff defended the town hall, telling CNBC, quote, "We need to represent both sides. I think it's important for America," end quote. The event proved chaotic. Mr. Trump unleashed a torrent of falsehoods and even mocked the moderator, Ms. Collins, as a nasty woman to cheers from the studio audience, which was organized by local Republican and civic groups. The forum was roundly criticized, and some CNN viewers said on social media that they would no longer watch the channel. To the shock of its staff, CNN began to occasionally dip below the conservative network Newsmax in total prime show viewership, a once inconceivable notion. Christiane Amanpour, the eminent CNN anchor, said in a speech that she and Mr. Licht respectfully disagree about airing the town hall. Amid the drama, CNN's once mighty financial foundation was eroding. Last year, CNN generated about $750 million in profit, down from about $1.25 billion the previous year. The lower number included about $200 million in one-time losses from CNN+. Mr. Licht's allies said on Wednesday that he had deserved more of a chance. Zasloff gave Chris 2 years. "I wish Chris had been given the 2 years Zasloff promised him," said Joe Scarborough, who created Morning Joe with Mr. Licht at MSNBC. "The best of Chris was still to come. He learned a lot. He's going to succeed and be much better because of what he learned there," end quote. Some CNN staff members regarded Wednesday's announcement, first reported by Puck, as a chance for a reset. "I want the coverage of CNN to be on our journalism," Mr. Tapper said in a text message. On Monday morning, roughly 48 hours before his fateful walk in the park with Mr. Zasloff, Mr. Licht had attempted to shore up support with a newsroom that had in many senses turned against him. "CNN is not about me. I should not be in the news unless it's taking arrows for you," he told his staff on a morning call. "Your work is what should be written about. This is the greatest job in the world at the greatest news organization in the world," Mr. Licht said. "And we have so much to look forward to in the months ahead. That's a quote. Our next headline, with migrant flights, DeSantis shows stoking outrage is the point. It is a political memo column by Shane Goldmacher. Ron DeSantis' decision to send migrants from near the Mexican border to the capital city of California is at first glance the latest in a series of escalating clashes between the Florida governor and his Democratic counterpart, Gavin Newsom. But the performative gambit in the early days of Mr. DeSantis' 2024 presidential run is better understood as an opening bid to prove to Republican primary voters that he can be just as much a provocateur and every bit as incendiary as former President Donald J. Trump. For Mr. DeSantis, the flights illustrate the broader bet he has made that the animating energy in the Republican Party today has shifted from conservatism to confrontationalism, and that in this new era, nothing is more fundamental than picking fights and making the right enemies, whether it's the migrants who have slogged sometimes thousands of miles to slip through the border, the news media, or the chief executive of the biggest blue state on the map. Mr. DeSantis has used this playbook before. He ordered up flights from the Texas border last year to the symbolically liberal hamlet of Martha's Vineyard, a stunt that drew exactly the outrage he sought. Those flights are now a staple of his stump speech, usually to cheers from the crowd. His allies in the Florida legislature earmarked $12 million of taxpayer money into the state budget this year for just this purpose. The easiest way to prove one's tribal loyalty in 2020's America is by theatrically hating the other tribe, said Russell Moore, the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today and the former president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. In recent days, two charter flights orchestrated by the DeSantis administration carried roughly three dozen migrants from a New Mexico airport to Sacramento. The migrants, who are mostly Venezuelan, said they had been recruited from outside a shelter in El Paso with promises of employment that California officials have said amounted to deception. Mr. Newsom, the California governor who is a potential future presidential contender himself, has suggested that the affair could merit kidnapping charges, calling Mr. DeSantis in a tweet a small, pathetic man. Mr. Moore said he believed that, quote, the migrants and asylum seekers are created in the image of God and shouldn't be mistreated or treated as political theater for anybody, end quote. But he could also see the more crass calculations that Mr. DeSantis is making in a polarized era, where politicians are most clearly defined not by what they're for, but by who they're against. The one heresy is that no tribe seems to allow is a refusal to hate the other tribe, Mr. Moore said. Mr. DeSantis, who flew to Arizona on Wednesday for a border event, is not a trailblazer in this regard. It was Mr. Trump who began his 2016 campaign by calling Mexicans rapists, who promised to build the wall, and later pitched a Muslim ban making an America First approach to immigration a central theme of the party. And it was Governor Greg Abbott of Texas who first began busing immigrants to blue cities and states last year, an idea Mr. Trump floated as president in 2018 but never pursued. Mr. DeSantis later one-upped Mr. Abbott's buses with the dramatic flights to Martha's Vineyard, which are now the subject of a federal class action lawsuit. At the demographic and geographic center of Mr. DeSantis' presidential candidacy is an effort to appeal to deeply conservative evangelical voters in Iowa, where the Republicans' 2024 nominating contest begins. Evangelical voters helped propel the Iowa victories of Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, and Mike Huckabee in the last three open contests. Yet the DeSantis campaign and its allies see fighting the left as the fastest way to appeal to those voters rather than overt displays of religiosity. Christians aren't looking for a savior to be a president, they already have one, said one DeSantis advisor who was not authorized to speak publicly to discuss strategy, explaining how Mr. Trump has dominated that voting bloc despite concerns about his moral character. Kevin Madden, who served as top advisor on Mitt Romney's 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns, said transporting migrants, however cynical, allowed Mr. DeSantis to agitate all the right people. "He's provoking Gavin Newsom," Mr. Madden said. Quote, "He's provoking the most extreme liberal voices to attack him. He is provoking media voices. And that works in his favor because it endears him to the forces on the right who want to see a clash of political civilizations." End quote. Outrage sells. Campaign contributions have repeatedly surged to the fury merchants on the right, whether the politicians selling the lie that the 2020 election was stolen, or the GOP hardliners who battled Representative Kevin McCarthy's ascent to the House speakership. An own-the-libs mentality has come to drive, if not define, the right online. On the left, Mr. Newsom has sought to elevate himself through his tussles with Mr. DeSantis, too. He ran a television advertisement in Florida attacking him last year. He challenged him to a debate. He traveled this spring to the New College of Florida, a public liberal arts institution where Mr. DeSantis is engineering a right-wing intellectual takeover. In his personal Twitter account, Mr. Newsom has slammed Mr. DeSantis by name at least 20 times. "I think I'm being generous, small and pathetic, very generous," Mr. Newsom said in an interview on NBC's Today Show broadcast on Wednesday. He accused Mr. DeSantis of using migrants as pawns, adding, quote, "He's just weakness masquerading as strength," end quote. Mr. Newsom's new pack has been running a rotation of online fundraising ads that attack Mr. DeSantis. "In my book, a bully and a coward doesn't deserve to be the leader of the free world," Mr. Newsom says of Mr. DeSantis in a video ad that began running on Facebook on Wednesday. Mr. DeSantis' roundtable discussion in Arizona on border security was a government event underwritten by taxpayers, not his campaign. After days of mystery, Mr. DeSantis' administration took credit for the Sacramento flights on Tuesday. On Wednesday, he did not mention Mr. Newsom by name, though he said sanctuary jurisdictions had incentivized illegal immigration. Then, Mr. DeSantis shifted to pick another fight with President Biden. "I don't know how you can just sit there and let the country be overrun with millions and millions of people coming illegally," Mr. DeSantis said. Mr. DeSantis has become an expert at agitating the right's boogeymen. He once called Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, a little elf who needed to be chucked across the Potomac. And when Mr. DeSantis's motives are questioned by reporters, his snapbacks have been quickly packaged and posted on social media in hopes of generating viral hits. If he were to become president, Mr. DeSantis has made plain he would use the White House's powers to the fullest. He is fond of saying that although he first won the governorship in 2018 with barely 50% of the vote, that victory came with 100% of the executive authority. As governor, he proudly used the power of the state to overrule local governments, ousting a prosecutor and prohibiting school districts from imposing mask mandates. Such actions are a departure from the limited government conservatism of yesteryear. His allies say it is a vivid signal to voters that Mr. DeSantis will leverage the powers of government to battle their enemies at a moment when many Republicans feel that their values and nation are under siege. Cesar Conda, a former chief of staff to Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who 2 decades ago served as the top domestic policy advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, said that Ronald Reagan would be rolling over in his grave using taxpayer dollars to fly migrants from one faraway state to another. DeSantis's move is part of a growing strain in conservatism, endorsed by younger conservatives, to aggressively use the power and resources of the government to achieve or coerce policy goals, Mr. Conda said. The less government, lower taxes, more freedom mantra of conservatism is becoming quaint and old-fashioned, unfortunately, end quote. Our next story is headlined, Disaster Upon Disaster, Flood Deepens Misery in Ukraine War Zone. It's by Andrew E. Kramer and Maria Varenikova. Alexei Kolesnik waded ashore and stood trembling on dry land for the first time in hours, rescued on Wednesday morning after spending the pre-dawn sitting on top of a cabinet in his flooded living room. "The water came really quickly," said Mr. Kolesnik, who was so weak he had to be helped out of a rubber boat by two rescue workers. "It happened so fast." Fetid, coffee-colored waters with plastic bags and bits of straw swirling in the eddies lapped at streets in Kherson, a regional capital in southern Ukraine, where rescuers had evacuated a neighborhood cut off by inundated streets. Exhausted residents spilled out of the rubber boats, carrying at most a purse or a backpack, sometimes a cat or a dog. The scene, overlooking a flooded square, was just one small snapshot of the vast devastation caused by the destruction on Tuesday of the Kakhovka Dam, swelling a more than 50-mile stretch of the Dnipro River until it swallowed docks, farms, gas stations, cars, factories, and houses. It would be a calamity in hot, calm times, but it hit a region ravaged and largely depopulated by war, where the river forms the line, front line, and providing basic services and communication was already a struggle. Carrying chemical pollution, dislodged landmines and assorted debris, a refrigerator here and red armchair there, the Dnipro reached its tainted fingers into drinking water supplies, drowned crops, and chased thousands of people from their ruined homes downstream. Upstream, it drastically lowered the reservoir that many Ukrainian farmers need to irrigate their fields and that the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant uses to cool its radioactive fuel. "We were getting used to the shelling, but I've never seen a situation like this," said Larisa Karchenko, a retired nurse in Kherson, who thought she might sit out the flood on Tuesday when water was knee-deep in her yard but not yet in her home. By Wednesday, it was spilling through her door. In some areas, it reached the roofs of houses. "It just keeps coming," she said. "Somebody needs to arrest Putin," she added, referring to President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, who ordered the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Ukrainian officials charged that Russian forces, which held the dam, blew it up to hinder a Ukrainian offensive, though little evidence about what happened has emerged so far. On the Russian-controlled riverbank, residents of the town of Oleshki pleaded for help in an online chat group, searching for missing loved ones and seeking assistance as floodwaters rose. Some wrote that they were gathering in the tallest buildings in their neighborhoods. Local officials, both Ukrainians who fled last year and those installed by the Russian occupation, said almost all of the town was flooded. "The water is coming. Help. I am begging you," one person wrote. "Three people on the roof, one of them elderly." Another wrote that three adults and a 15-year-old boy were on a roof and that the boy was panicking. Another post said three children were stranded in a house. "The second floor is flooding," it said, "asking for help from anyone who cares." Katerina Kovtun posted on the forum searching for her grandparents in Oleshki and learned late Tuesday that they had been rescued from a rooftop and taken to a nearby village. "What is next, I don't know," she said. Oleshki was one of 35 towns affected on the Russian-held side of the river, said Vladimir Saldo, the Kremlin-installed regional administrator. The city of Kherson, a hub of Ukraine's agriculture industry, lies on the western Ukrainian-controlled bank of the Dnipro. Last year it fell to the invading forces. Most residents fled and it was occupied for months. The Russians retreated in November, but have continued to bombard the already battered city and the surrounding region from across the river. Many neighborhoods on bluffs above the river were untouched by the flood, but low-lying areas were a panorama of water and floating debris. Rescuers ventured out in boats to pull stranded, frightened people from roofs or upper floors of homes, with the occasional boom of artillery in the background. The entire Ostriv neighborhood, one of the areas most vulnerable to Russian shelling, was evacuated. Alas Negor, 55, a biology teacher, stepped out of a boat and looked back at the flooded city streets. "Think of what is in this flood," she said, quote, "pesticides, chemicals, oil, dead animals and fish, and also it washed away graveyards," end quote. Landmines the Army had planted have washed free, some blowing up and others tumbling with the current to new sites, the United Nations warned. Sergei Litovsky, 60, an electrician, said he was most worried about the long struggle ahead for southern Ukraine, one of the world's richest agricultural zones and reliant on irrigation, mostly from the quickly draining reservoir. Without water, nobody will live here, he said. The legacy of this will last dozens of years. The scale of the disruption was hard to fathom, he said. Quote, without war, this would be a major catastrophe, but this came along with the war, end quote. Some people displaced by the flood were shuttled by train to Mykolaiv, a Black Sea port city less than 40 miles to the northwest of Kherson. Mykolaiv was already strained by its role as a transit hub or temporary home for many people fleeing the fighting. The Mykolaiv region held about 190,000 internally displaced Ukrainians before the dam broke, according to the United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Office. The flooding, the office said, will likely worsen an already fragile humanitarian situation. Thousands of children were among those fleeing, it said. Many difficulties lie ahead for southern Ukraine, including finding long-term housing for thousands of people, towns and cities, including Kryvyi Rih, an iron ore mining and steel smelting hub, were deprived of drinking water, which had been drawn from the reservoir. The Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant was the South's major source of electricity before the war. Now in Russian hands, it has been damaged by shelling and is not supplying power to the grid. It has enough cooling water for now, but its future remains deeply in doubt. This is a catastrophe for the whole South, said Roman Kostenko, the chairman of the Defense and Intelligence Committee in Ukraine's parliament. But on Wednesday, the task was saving people, he said, adding, later, we will deal with the legacy. Mr. Kostenko, who is also a colonel in the Ukrainian army, was on Wednesday coordinating the efforts of soldiers who had flown drones to harry Russian forces with dropped hand grenades. Now they were flying bottled water and food to people stranded on rooftops. Staggering to shore from rubber boats after a night and day spent on roofs in flooded areas, several people said they had been visited by drones as they waited. I was sitting on the roof of my house when a drone came by and dropped a bottle of sparkling water, said Hennady Rotar, 59. Quote, in 10 minutes, another drone came by and dropped a can of meat, end quote. With his location pinpointed by the drone, a rescue boat soon showed up. I thought I would spend another night on the roof, he said. Katerina Krupich, 40, her son Maxim, 12, and daughter Maria, 4, all came ashore exhausted and barefoot. They'd been stranded on a roof on an island near the Russian-controlled eastern bank. On Wednesday, a Ukrainian Special Forces unit of the Domestic Intelligence Agency, in coordination with drone operators, began rescues in this area across the rolling, swollen river. Ms. Krupich said drones had dropped water for the family before its rescue. When the three came ashore, a soldier carrying Maria, a crowd circled around and offered candies to the children. Another day and that would have been it, said Maxim of the family's time, trapped without food and water on the rooftop. Elena Nechai, a lawyer, said the workshop of her husband's company, which specializes in repairing construction cranes, was flooded. All the equipment is underwater, she said. Building the company was his whole life, she said. Ms. Nechai was waiting at the launching point for boats as her husband paddled out to rescue a watchman who was stranded at the site. The couple had hazard insurance, she said, but early in the war, the insurance company had taken pains to point out a clause in the contract clarifying that it did not cover acts of war. It would be hard now, she said, to argue that the flood was anything other than an act of war. And now a story headlined, Liberal prosecutors are revisiting police killings, but charging few officers so far. It's by Eliza Fawcett and Tim Arango. Augustin Gonzalez was shot dead in 2018 by police officers in Hayward, California, when he refused to drop a sharp object during a confrontation on a dark street. Andrew Maupin Buckskin was killed by Oakland officers in 2007 after he ran away following a car chase, hid under a vehicle, and failed to comply with their demands. 2 years ago, Mario Gonzalez died after he was pinned on the ground for more than 5 minutes by officers in Alameda, California. In all three cases, prosecutors determined that the police should not be criminally charged, seemingly closing the book. But shortly after she became the district attorney of Alameda County in January, Pamela Price initiated a new review of those cases and five others in one of the most extensive re-examinations of police killings launched by progressive prosecutors. Ms. Price's review is notable because her predecessors had already cleared the officers of wrongdoing, and two of the reopened cases occurred more than 15 years ago. As high-profile instances of police brutality shocked the public in recent years and raised questions about official law enforcement accounts, liberal prosecutors campaigned on the promise that they would review cases that they felt were hastily closed without charges. Their efforts to revisit old cases have won praise from the activists and liberal Democrats who voted for them. But the re-examinations so far have rarely led to criminal charges. To reopen a police use of force case is in many ways a Herculean task, said Steve Descano, the Commonwealth's attorney in Fairfax County, Virginia. He lost in court after he charged two Federal Park police officers for the 2017 shooting of a man who fled a car crash, a case that the Justice Department previously reviewed and declined to pursue. The incidents almost never have evidence as stark as the bystander video showing George Floyd being pinned to the ground in 2020 for more than 9 minutes by Derek Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer who was convicted of murdering Mr. Floyd. The circumstances often are more ambiguous, the footage less telling. And once a district attorney writes a lengthy memo detailing why criminal charges are unjustified against a police officer, it can be difficult for a successor to overcome those arguments, absent new evidence. Everybody is going to go through it again, and the outcome in all probability is going to be the same, said Jim Pasco, the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police. Quote, "And what's Einstein's definition of insanity?" End quote. The biggest hurdle for pursuing criminal charges is the wide latitude that officers have to use force. State legislatures, including California's, have tried to narrow that ability, but officers generally can still use lethal force when they feel they or others could be killed, a level of immunity that law enforcement officials say is necessary to ensure the public's safety. Alameda County, Ms. Price's jurisdiction, covers a large swath of the East Bay across from San Francisco, containing 14 cities and numerous police departments. In the county seat of Oakland, where the Black Panther Party emerged in the 1960s, a legacy of radical politics is intertwined with a troubled history of law enforcement. The Oakland Police Department has been under federal oversight for more than two decades. Ms. Price campaigned on a liberal platform that, besides reviewing old cases, included removing local residents from death row and resentencing inmates serving life sentences, an effort, she said, to restore public trust. Since taking office, she has directed her staff to seek the lowest possible prison sentence for most crimes. She said that in the past, prosecutors routinely gave officers a pass when they killed someone on the job, and she wants questionable police killings to face the same rigor that other criminal cases get. "Every case that we're looking at now was determined under a double standard," Ms. Price said in an interview. Quote, "Police officers received a different standard of justice than everyday people," end quote. Ms. Price is among a growing cadre of progressive prosecutors elected over the last decade, beginning with the 2016 elections of Kim Fox in Chicago and Kimberly Gardner in St. Louis, on promises of reducing jail populations and holding police accountable. The movement gained steam after Floyd's murder. Some prominent district attorneys have since faced a backlash over crime concerns. Chesa Boudin was recalled last year in San Francisco, while Ms. Gardner resigned last week as she faced criticism for her handling of violent crime. Ms. Fox is not running for re-election next year and has endured criticism from moderates and conservatives, especially for her support of eliminating cash bail statewide. In Maine, a police officer has never been prosecuted for an on-duty killing. But in July 2020, Natasha Irving, the district attorney for four counties, said she would seek charges for the 2007 police shooting death of Gregory Jackson, who was drunk and ran away after a routine traffic stop in Waldoboro, the town where Ms. Irving grew up. 3 years later, however, Ms. Irving said that based on the Attorney General's review of the forensics from the case, she will not file charges. It's just not going to be a provable case, she said in an interview. In the Virginia case pursued by Mr. Descano, Behan Geyser, 25, was involved in a minor car crash and then fled in his Jeep, pursued by two officers who cornered Mr. Geyser in a residential neighborhood. When the vehicle moved toward a police car, they opened fire, killing him. Mr. Descano brought a case, but a judge dismissed the charges, ruling the officers reasonably feared they were in danger. His efforts to pursue the case further were rejected by the state's attorney general and the Justice Department. Such reviews offer the possibility of justice for still grieving families, but many may unrealistically raise their hopes. Carla Gonzalez, the mother of Mr. Gonzalez, the man who was killed in Hayward, said she was torn when she heard Ms. Price was reopening her son's case. Television outlets began replaying the body camera footage of Mr. Gonzalez's confrontation with police. For his family, all of the anger, grief, and unresolved questions came rushing back. Why had the officers not tried to de-escalate the situation? I was excited to know that it was going to be opened up again, Ms. Gonzalez said. Quote, at the same time, I was very nervous that it was going to be another roadblock, another failure. End quote. Less than 2% of police killings result in charges, according to Philip M. Stinson, a professor of criminal justice at Bowling Green State University. That figure has not budged since 2020. The number of people killed by police is holding steady. Last year it was 1,200, compared with 1,147 in 2022, according to Mapping Police Violence. This concludes the reading of the New York Times for today. Your reader for today has been Scott Johnson. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions concerning this program, please feel free to call us at 859-422-6390. 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening, and now please stay tuned for continued programming on Radio I.